June 22nd. Yesterday we went to town to communicate with the lawyer and do a bit of shopping. I also paid the mortuary bill. Then when returning, I found myself in a state of something like rebellion. I felt a certain anger that somehow nature, or whatever it is that rules, should have done this to me and to her. I was in a positive state, in a negative mood. And then, later that day, sitting in the little garden, I found myself in a state of dryness. This is familiar in the history of mystical consciousness. In the case of Madame Guyon, she experienced protracted intervals of dryness, and then periods when she was on beam and productive. The fact is that out of dryness one feels no enthusiasm whatsoever. If he produced, it would be a contrived production, not an inspired production, and probably of very little value. And last night, I woke very early. I think I heard the clock strike 2 and did not sleep thereafter. And when I was at one time sinking down to sleep, then there was a sense of suffocation and apparently too little ventilation. It may be something like the second phase of Chain-Stoke breathing. During more recent days, since the departure of Gertrude, I find my thoughts spontaneously reverting to the Passion of the Christ as given in the Christian Gospels. I think of this passage as a kind of Golgotha. I seem to know what it means to sweat blood. I feel the agony of that state of exhaustion and the pain of nearly run out endurance. To complicate the problem, there are the outer demands of the estate and of winding up the costs and so forth connected with the passing of Gertrude and the financial affairs connected with daily living and so forth, the bookkeeping and all that. And meanwhile, with the state of the vision so dim and its effect upon the memory, so I do not remember clearly, I am standing on the edge of an outer confusion as well as being involved in an inner confusion. The task seems to be impossible. Oh, damn it. Oh, damn it. Continuation of the tape connected with the developments following the death of Gertrude. In the case of the realization of August 7th, 1936, I had been strongly oriented to Shankara, and he gave me the key whereby that realization became possible. This was a confirmation of the position taken in the Advaita Vedanta. It may be said that with this I had become a Vedantist. But at that time I had not followed the renunciation implied by the Kuan Yin vow or the voice of the silence. However, because of the obvious ethical value of this renunciation, I did follow that course, so that I renounced the fruits of it and the purpose of accepting a nirvanic retreat. This took me into an orientation which I find only in Buddhism. The purpose of the renunciation, as given in the voice of the silence, is to effect the redemption of all creatures. In the voice of the silence, the renunciation is said to continue for unnumbered kalpas, and that there is no compensation for this renunciation. However, one whom I called Senior and who had counseled me at that time advised me to watch for an event involving the cycle of 33. Though I did not know the length of time or the unit of time involved in this cycle, it proved to be a cycle of 33 days. And on that 33rd day, during the night between the 8th and 9th of September, there walked into my consciousness a realization that transcended the one of August 7th, 1936. But it was not a realization that brought a state of the high bliss or ananda that was characteristic of the first one. It brought a state that I would call neutral, as lying between the subject and the object, or also as lying between the nirvanic consciousness and the samsaric consciousness. And it involved a capacity to move either way. It was a state transcending bliss in that it gave a certain command. One could, as it were, enter into bliss, but one could also participate in the suffering of creatures. I had never heard of anything like this at that time from anything I had seen in the literature, and it was a most unexpected experience. Because the state was neutral, I called it a state of indifference, and more particularly, the state of high indifference, a state which does not mean an indifference to human suffering or to the problems of mankind, but a state that was neutral between the nirvanic and the samsaric. I found that the movement toward the nirvanic could be identified with the movement towards the subject in the compound of relative consciousness, and the movement toward the samsaric could be identified with the movement towards the object in the complex of consciousness. It thus was a state that was oriented to consciousness as such, rather than to that which is consciousness, or to the content of consciousness, and was the basis of the title of the book called The Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object. Now, in studying the relationship to nirvana, or to the state of bliss, it seemed that it was a movement away from the immediate experiencing of bliss in the foreground of consciousness to a position in the background, as it were. And since then, it has been true that I have been able, under some conditions, to bestow a degree, a sample, as it were, of the experience of bliss. It is as though, by renouncing bliss as a state for oneself, one attained the capacity to bestow it upon others to a degree. It was clear to me that this was a more comprehensive realization than the first one, and indeed was a magnificent compensation for the renunciation. It thus did not prove to be true, as the voice of the silence indicated, that there was no compensation. I spoke of this to Senior, and he said the reason for that extreme statement was the aim of rendering the motivation completely disinterested, that in point of fact, there never is a suspension of the principle of compensation. This meant then that I had embraced in my experience both a Vedantic type of orientation and a Buddhistic type of orientation. It would make of me both a Vedantist and a Buddhist at the same time. Only the Buddhistic orientation was the more advanced of the two. Often in meditation, or in the breakthrough to a state of ananda, the motivation seems to be an enjoyment of ananda for its own sake. And this suggests something like a spiritual hedonism. It has not appeared to me to be overly manly. The Buddhist orientation, on the other hand, is not a dedication to the personal enjoyment of a state of bliss, but to the performance of an action that is of value to the world of not only all humans, but to all creatures. In other words, the end of the attainment or meaning of it is not withdrawal to a private satisfaction, but a preparation for a work serving the needs of all creatures In other words, to become a co-worker with the law. It has been evident for some time that I have within me a deep affinity for chakra. When I had access to its thought, I found it had a great familiarity, that indeed, often when I started a sentence, I knew what was coming before I read it. So evidently this was something from the past. There are those who have suggested an identity between myself and chakra, but I have never claimed this. Let me suggest rather that there is a kind of parallelism. Now, if we are to take the account given under the mystery of Buddha in the so-called third volume of the Secret Doctrine as valid, then there is a development given here that is of premier interest. It is there said that actually Shankara had in his constitution the intermediate principle of the Buddha, and that his own intermediate principle had been withdrawn, and that the period of the action of this intermediate principle, or Trukha of the Buddha, continued for 32 years and then was withdrawn, and the corresponding principle that was proper to Shankara was returned to him. It had meanwhile been kept in some place of which I have heard something, but did not participate in the work in which Shankara was engaged. The effect of this obviously would be a great slump in consciousness. Shankara had been moving on an extremely lofty level and participated in the consciousness of the Buddha. But all of a sudden, he had his own intermediate principle which had not participated in that, and that could correspond very easily to a great slump in consciousness and could quite easily precipitate a major depression. It is then said that Shankara entered a cave and has never been seen since. But the implication was that he withdrew from life and had the power to do so by some act of will. But in so doing, he had invoked karma, and in a quoted source said to come from the Tibetan, it is said that the penalty of such an act is that the individual must face death by violence against his will at the same age in a later incarnation. The immediate suggestion is an identification with such an event in the case of the Christ. And here comes in a strange and significant development. Here a footnote is indicated. I am assuming the correctness of the determination of the date of Shankara that is given by Soubirous and is accepted in theosophical literature. This date is 510 B.C., about 50 years after the final nirvana of Buddha. That, therefore, would make it possible for the incarnation of the Christ to have been that of Shankara, so far as the time factor is concerned. End of the footnote. Returning to the text. A rather obvious objection to the conception that the Christ is another appearance of Shankara is the fact that Christ was a man of a very different kind of temperament. He was preeminently a man of feeling. He was not a philosopher, not an abstract thinker, but he gave instructions in a simple form that could be understood by a simple people. And it was obvious that the quality of feeling and compassion was very high in him. And the ordinary idea would be that if a great philosopher reincarnates, he would manifest something of the same qualities. But this, I think, is a misapprehension. It would seem reasonable to suppose that the monad, which we really are, and from which we come, would put forth at any given time on this earth an entity manifesting a certain limited portion of the total nature of that monad. That limited portion would develop throughout the life and indicate a given kind of character and a given group of capacities. But then, when withdrawn back, the next projection would be not necessarily of the same sort, but of a complementary sort, as it were, the other side of the entity. In one case, the thinker, in the second case, the man of feeling. So I find no contradiction whatever in the fact that Christ was not a great philosopher. The karmic consequence of the suicidal withdrawal of Shankara would thus be the crucifixion of the Christ, or a death by violence in the subsequent incarnation. Now, in Christianity, the very center of the orientation of the supposed saving power of the Christ is centered upon this crucifixion, and it has become an object of extensive theological speculation. For my part, I reject the theological speculation as being significant. Nonetheless, this was an important event which led to a resurrection. And this can presage a pattern which can be experienced by others. The passing through an experience that is equivalent to a crucifixion, involving the extreme of suffering, and followed later by a resurrection in terms of a new order of capacities. Now, the relevance of these events with respect to my own immediate problem is that it has happened that my thought of late has gravitated to the story of the Via Dolorosa, the passion of the Christ, which led to the crucifixion. This was a spontaneous thing, not a worked out development. If I am passing through a parallelism with Shankara, then this becomes part of my own experience. The crucifixion through which I passed was the death of Gurdjieff, which involved a passage through states of feeling far greater than that of the ordinary human experience when one loses a beloved. It has introduced a degree of suffering far greater than I've ever known before, and does indeed have the value of a crucifixion, and has in fact forced a kind of an antiodromia, so that though all my life my center of focus has been in a philosophical, mathematical, or scientific line of emphasis, I have gone over into a state in which the principle of feeling has taken precedence. And I tend to speak in terms of drama rather than in terms of philosophy. I have felt the agonies that might be called the sweating of blood and all of that, and it has all been as if on a scale far transcending the purely personal. Now the thing that seems to emerge is that I am, by all of this intensely difficult experience, being forced, as it were, to take a further step in a kind of realization. The kind of realization, namely, that would correspond to the particular outlook of the Christ, in which feeling was predominant, and in which association with certain women was an important part of the total experience. Remember that Mary the mother was weeping at the foot of the cross, and that Mary Magdalene was the first to discover that the Christ had arisen according to the story. And he had other important relationships in his lines of influence with women, whereas the development in connection with the Vedantic type of realization or the Buddhistic form was a development in terms that were exclusively masculine. And I must confess concerning myself that I have had all these years an orientation to the masculine mind. I produced for it and simply permitted women to listen in. But now there is coming into my consciousness this strange change of attitude where it might be said that the feminine side of my own nature is emerging to a place of greater importance than it ever had before. Now there seems to be emerging in my own inner development a demand that I participate in the experience or realization that is typical of the really authentic Christianity which lies beneath the theological speculations, and that I'm going over a path that embraces three stages instead of the two earlier ones alone. But in the case of this step, a heavy and important enantiodromia was required, and it was impossible to do that without the production of a fundamental shock, a shock equivalent psychologically to a crucifixion. And that is what was involved in the death of Gertrude. It is a combination, thus, of something that is intensely personal and also of something that has collective implications. All of this was apparently prefigured in the great dream that was handled earlier in the light of Robert Johnson's interpretation of it. If I am indeed living through the stages of the chakra experience for the purpose of bringing about an integration of three elements, this experience that I'm passing through at the present moment begins to make sense. The integration was therefore incomplete when it brought together that which was Vedantic and that which was Buddhistic, but had to go on to include that which was Christian in the fundamental sense, not the theological overburden and vast misinterpretation. And along with this is the step that involves the inclusion of the feminine aspect in the basic religious symbolism. Thus, therefore, the exclusively masculine orientation in the basic religion of the East, and also in the theological form of Christianity, gave insufficient emphasis to the feminine component, and even excluded it completely. And that the end to be achieved here is something like an integration that brings in the feminine half of humanity into the great religious experience. It would become clear why the withdrawal of Gertrude was necessary, for nothing could have shocked me so deeply as that. It had the force of a crucifixion, forced in an antiodromia, and is bringing forth in my consciousness a sort of dramatic element, a story element, which was foreign to all of the orientation which was normal to my whole life heretofore. In the discussion of Dr. Brew Joy, he spoke of this very reversal of one's orientation, and that its ultimate end was not to cease to be the philosopher, but add to the philosopher the message that belongs to the heart. In a way, it is the bringing together of that which in the classical terminology is the integration of logos and eros. That which I am passing through at the present time is of extreme difficulty. It's well nigh impossible to get any rest whatsoever. It seems to involve the utmost of strain, and it disturbs the state of peace completely. But if it is bringing about something that is of collective value, all of this pain may ultimately be justified. Robert Johnson's interpretation of the great dream involving Mephisto, the anima, and the sage was to the effect that it was an archetypal dream and therefore was of more than personal importance, that in fact it carried a collective force, and that the personality was living through a process that would produce collective effects and pioneering a way over which others would follow later. This may be so, and this may be the reason why I personally have had to go through this ordeal, which indeed has the value of a crucifixion.